Back in the 1920s, ballrooms popped up across the United States, including in Detroit. The music that filled Detroit's dance halls was jazz. Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with Jim Gallert, a veteran jazz broadcaster, researcher, and writer. Together with Lars Bjorn, he wrote Before Motown, A History of Jazz in Detroit, 1920 to 1960. Emmanuel Berry joins us now. So what did you learn about Detroit's jazz history, Emmanuel?
Well, a lot. There is a bunch of material, and it's really way too much to try and squeeze into a single segment.
Yeah.
But if you're going to try and sort your way through all of this stuff in Detroit's jazz history, a good place to start is with Gene Goldkett.
And who is Gene Goldkett?
So Goldkett was a musical child prodigy. He trained in Moscow. But him and his mother, they relocated to Chicago, and he soon kind of realized that he would make more money if he was a dance pianist. So he started to work for Edgar Benson, who controlled many of the dance bands in Chicago and got kind of into the business side of things. Goldkett eventually ended up moving to Detroit, and as Jim Gallert explains, in 1922 he purchased the Greystone Ballroom.
The largest and most elegant of all the ballrooms in Detroit. There were about a dozen of them during the 1920s. So Goldkett was poised to become sort of the Edgar Benson of Detroit, if you will. And he controlled over a dozen bands at his height in the 1920s. So Goldkett was a very powerful guy. And his band, his main band, became one of the two most influential or noted Detroit bands in the 1920s.
The Greystone was segregated, as most ballrooms were at the time, but black bands did play there for white audiences. And one of the bands that Goldkett helped to build was McKinney's Cotton Pickers. And from the name, you would assume that they were raised in the Deep South or something, but that wasn't the case.
No, that was the way black entertainment was packaged for white audiences during the 20s and the 30s and the 1940s, and probably even a bit later. There was some connotation that would, in the name of the band or the name of the club that they performed at, to let you know it was either black-owned or that the band was an African-American band, and that's what the name McKinney's Cotton Pickers did for that particular band that was under the leadership of a guy named William McKinney, who was a businessman. He was a lot like Gene Goldkett in many ways. And Goldkett hired McKinney's band in the spring of 1927, brought them to Detroit, and in the fall of 1927, the band moved over to the Greystone from where they'd been playing. And Goldkett also got them a recording contract with Victor. And again, they had to go to Chicago, and where they made most of their recordings, and or to New York, where they made some. And like Goldkett's band, they had a distinctive sound that's difficult to describe in words.
I have a clip actually from both of those bands, and I want to play them just to kind of get a sense of the variety that was there at the time. So up first I have, this is Gene Goldkett's orchestra. This is My Pretty Girl. Now I have for McKinney's Cotton Pickers, this is Will You, Won't You Be My Babe. It grooves.
It's a great track, and you notice you can hear the banjo in there, Dave Wilborn. Don Redman, who was the musical director, loved the sound of the banjo and the brass bass, and he was one of the last band leaders to abandon them in favor of a string bass and a guitar. And he uses them to great advantage there. I mean, the band has a really relaxed sound. It wasn't exactly what people would think of when they say, let's go get hot, man, play hot music, with a real rapid-fire tempo, more like what Goldkett's band was playing. And the cotton pickers could definitely get hot and play hot music, but they could also play a relaxed, more melodic sounding music. So those are both great tracks by great bands.
The ballroom era eventually came to an end, and Gold Cut even goes bankrupt. But after World War II, jazz kind of reemerges in Detroit. How does it reemerge different than that ballroom era jazz?
Well, by the 1940s and even by the late 1930s, Detroit had a great educational system. There were music courses taught in most of the high schools around Detroit. And there were some great musicians that that taught the students. So what we see in the late 30s and then in the 40s, we see now Detroit-trained musicians, guys who didn't come from elsewhere, like Ohio or New York or Chicago, but were actually born and raised in the city. And they could, you know, they had enough, they stayed long enough to take places in bands and work in Detroit bands around the city.
So they're not playing in these big ballrooms anymore. They're playing these small clubs in Paradise Valley and John R. Street a bit. I mean, what was that kind of atmosphere like for musicians?
Paradise Valley was the center of gravity for the African-American population in Detroit. It was a culture and business center. And that was where black folks played in clubs. You know, they owned a lot of the establishments. John R. Street emerged in the mid-1940s. It was dubbed the Street of Music. It was a whole string of clubs, about a dozen clubs, if not more, that ran up and down the length of John R. By the time John R. came up, the nature of the shows had shifted. The music that was presented, the entertainment that was presented in the clubs. Some of the clubs in Paradise Valley had floor shows. They would have a band to play for intermission and dancing, and then they would have a floor show and vocalists and things like that. And on John R., there were still some show bars, but a lot, there were more clubs where people would just go in and sit down and listen to the music.
There were a lot of musicians around this time, Thad and Elvin Jones, Terry Hollard, they're all playing in these areas, but a lot of them are kind of recruited away from the Motor City for a while, at least. What influence did Detroit musicians have in shaping the jazz world at large?
By the early 1950s, there was a sizable exodus of Detroit musicians who went on to Manhattan. It actually started before then. There were guys leaving by the mid-40s, but the 50s, though, which was really what Lars Bjorn, my friend and colleague Lars Bjorn, calls the golden age of Detroit jazz, because there were so many musicians that had all received a great musical education in the city, informal as well as formal, as well as through the high schools. And they started going to Manhattan in such numbers that some of the New Yorkers called it the Detroit invasion. There were so many Detroit musicians that went to New York City. As far as the influence of the musicians, what people would find, what New Yorkers found, was that all the Detroit musicians could read music very well, and they all had they were all really good too. So that they all sounded distinctive. You know, they didn't sound the same like a whole mass of musicians that sound the very similar to one another. The trumpet players sounded different. I mean, all the Detroit musicians had developed their own sound, which is the hallmark of that's what a jazz soloist wants to be. A jazz musician wants to have his own sound or her own sound.
Many of those musicians who ended up staying in the city ended up working in Motown. You know, jazz kind of became overshadows isn't the right word. Maybe started to help shape R&B. What role did Detroit jazz play in developing Motown sound?
Well, the thing is that the Motown sound was really created by the musicians. It wasn't created by the vocal groups. If you watch the film Standing in the Shadows of Motown, you can hear, you recognize all the songs that the musicians play immediately. And it really, they're all performed, sung by different vocalists, different from the original recordings. But the band still sounds like, it still sounds like Motown, because the musicians were the same. Berry Gordy knew that the musicians could, because they were improvisers, they could create a sound, and they were never lost for ideas, whereas a regular studio musician might not have the grab bag of riffs or licks or notes that the jazz guys could grab onto and throw out in a second. So he took advantage of their creativity and their creative natures. One of the first records Berry Gordy released was a song called Come to Me by a vocalist named Marv Johnson, Marvelous Marv Johnson. And there's a brief flute solo in that song that's created by Beans Bowles. You know I miss you, baby. That's one example of an improvised passage in a Motown record, but there were many others.
Where does jazz music in Detroit stand today?
There are problems with the school system. A lot of money, because of the dire straits in which Detroit finds itself. A lot of the educational programs have been severely cut. But the Detroit Jazz Festival steps up, and they send musicians into schools to conduct classes. So the ball is being picked up by others. WEMU, your sister public radio station in Ipsy, they help support jazz education. So does Vincent York's Jazzistry. And also the thing is, the Detroit way in jazz is really musicians, older musicians show the younger musicians how to do it, how to play. They help them. There's dozens of musicians that that teach on a private basis. And also there's the best informal education you can get if you go to a club, and most clubs that feature jazz, and there are not too many now, but the ones which do offer jam session nights, where younger musicians can go and, you know, and sit in with a real, you know, a working jazz musician, a group of them, and learn. And that's a tradition that goes back to the 1920s. Musicians were always having jam sessions, you know, they were learning and sharing and trading ideas. And that's something that was never based on color. None of the music is based on color. It's all based on notes. And what kind of sound you get, and how much feeling you have in your notes. That's the whole thing.
Jim Gellert is a veteran jazz broadcaster, researcher, and writer. Together with Lars Bjorn, he wrote Before Motown, A History of Jazz in Detroit, 1920 to 60. Lars and Jim also run the website Detroit Music History. Jim, thanks for your time.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
For Current State, I'm Emmanuel Berry.